So we're back in our chapter 11, the master of the work. Let's begin with the last sentence of the section we completed last time, which says, only when the small ego sense is rooted out from the nature, can the seeker know his true person that stands above as a portion and power of the divine, and renounce all motive force other than the will of the divine Shakti. So he commends to us a knowledge of the eternal source of our individuality in the divine, what he would call in the life divine and in his letters on yoga, the central being, the Jivatman, who stands outside the phenomenal play of time in this triple divided universe, but is above. So he suggests then that this poise of being is key to the integration, to the making one of nature and spirit. So, now we begin. There are gradations in this last integralizing movement, for it cannot be done at once or without long approaches that bring it progressively nearer and make it at last possible. The first attitude to be taken is to cease to regard ourselves as the worker and firmly to realize that we are only one instrument of the cosmic force. So again, phases of the work. Living increasingly in communion with the master of the work. And this harkens back to what he wrote in the fifth chapter of the book, The Mother. At first, it is not the one force, but many cosmic forces that seem to move us. But these may be turned into feeders of the ego, and this vision liberates the mind, but not the rest of the nature. Even when we become aware of all as the working of one cosmic force and of the divine behind it, that too need not liberate. If the egoism of the worker disappears, the egoism of the instrument may replace it or else prolong it in a disguise. The life of the world has been full of instances of egoism of this kind, and it can be more engrossing and enormous than any other. There is the same danger in yoga. A man becomes a leader of men, or eminent in a large or lesser circle, and feels himself full of a power that he knows to be beyond his own ego force. He may be aware of a fate acting through him, or a will mysterious and unfathomable, or a light within of great brilliance. There are extraordinary results of his thoughts, his actions, or his creative genius. He effects some tremendous destruction that clears the path for humanity, or some great construction that becomes its momentary resting place. He is a scourge, or he is a bringer of light and healing, a creator of beauty, or a messenger of knowledge. Or if his work and its effects are on a lesser scale and have a limited field, still, they are attended by the strong sense that he is an instrument and chosen for his mission or his labor. Men who have this destiny and these powers come easily to believe and declare themselves to be mere instruments in the hands of God or of fate. But even in the Declaration, we can see that there can intrude or take refuge an intenser and more exaggerated egoism than ordinary men have the courage to assert or the strength to house within them. And often, if men of this kind speak of God, it is to erect an image of him which is really nothing but a huge shadow of themselves or their own nature, a sustaining deific essence of their own type of will and thought and quality and force. This magnified image of their ego is the master whom they serve. This happens only too often in yoga to strong but crude vital natures or minds too easily exalted when they allow ambition, pride, or the desire of greatness to enter into their spiritual seeking and vitiate its purity of motive. A magnified ego stands between them and their true being and grasps for its own personal purpose the strength from a greater unseen power, divine or undivine, acting through them, of which they become vaguely or intensely aware. An intellectual perception or vital sense of a force greater than ours and of ourselves as moved by it is not sufficient to liberate from the ego. Well, I think the history of the last 60 or 70 years has sufficiently outlined such personalities that we need not linger upon them and give them our notice. They are plentiful in the political sphere, and they are plentiful in the spheres of yoga as it has been introduced to the West. This perception, this sense of a greater power in us or above and moving us, is not a hallucination or a megalomania. Those who feel, those who thus feel and see, have a larger sight than ordinary men and have advanced a step beyond the limited physical intelligence. But theirs is not the plenary vision or the direct experience. For because they are not clear in mind and aware in the soul, because their awakening is more in the vital parts than into the spiritual substance of self, they cannot be the conscious instruments of the divine or come face to face with the master, but are used through their fallible and imperfect nature. The most they see of the divinity is a fate or a cosmic force, or else they give his name to a limited godhead, or worse, to a titanic or demoniac power that veils him. Even certain religious founders have erected the image of the god of a sect or a national god or a power of terror and punishment or a newman of sattvic love and mercy and virtue, and seem not to have seen the one and eternal. The divine accepts the image they make of him and does his work in them through that medium. But since the one force is felt and acts in their imperfect nature, but more intensely than in others, the motive principle of egoism too can be more intense in them than in others. This goes back to the Bhagavad Gita, which calls our attention to how the divine agrees to use all forms through which it advances its cosmic purpose, regardless of the nature of the ignorance, that all things are driven forward according to their nature, and their nature essentially is divinely born, and so they are missioned forth with a purpose, and maybe it starts darkly, but still there's a divine hand guiding. But as we stumble towards awareness, We become aware in limited phases of what the largeness of this power intends and what we might do. An exalted rajasic or sattvic ego still holds them and stands between them and the integral truth. Even this is something, a beginning, although far from the true and perfect experience. A much worse thing may befall those who break something of the human bonds, but have not purity and not the knowledge. For they may become instruments, but not of the divine. Too often, using his name, they serve unconsciously his masks and black contraries, the powers of darkness. And of course, some serve consciously. Our nature must house the cosmic force, but not in its lower aspect or in its rajasic or sattvic movement. It must serve the universal will, but in the light of a greater liberating knowledge. There must be no egoism of any kind in the attitude of the instrument, even when we are fully conscious of the greatness of the force within us. So, that is again the mother in chapter 5. And let's read that short section. But a time will come when you will feel more and more that you are the instrument and not the worker. For first, by the force of your devotion, your contact with the Divine Mother will become so intimate that at all times you will have only to concentrate and to put everything into her hands to have her present guidance, her direct command or impulse, the sure indication of the thing to be done and the way to do it and the result. And afterwards, you will realize that the divine Shakti not only inspires and guides, but initiates and carries out your works. All your movements are originated by her. All your powers are hers. Mind, life, and body are conscious and joyful instruments of her action, means for her play, molds for her manifestation in the physical universe. There can be no more happy condition than this union and dependence. For this step carries you back beyond the borderline from the life of stress and suffering in the ignorance, into the truth of your spiritual being, into its deep peace and its intense ananda. While this transformation is being done, it is more than ever necessary to keep yourself free from all taint of the perversions of the ego. Let no demand or insistence creep in to stain the purity or the self-giving and the sacrifice. There must be no attachment to the work or the result, no laying down of conditions, no claim to possess the power that should possess you, no pride of the instrument, no vanity or arrogance. Nothing in the mind or in the vital or physical parts should be suffered to distort to its own use or seize for its own personal and separate satisfaction the greatness of the forces that are acting through you. Let your faith, your sincerity, your purity of aspiration be absolute and pervasive of all the planes and layers of the being. Then every disturbing element and distorting influence will progressively fall away from your nature. And back now to the synthesis of yoga. Every man is knowingly or unknowingly the instrument of a universal power. And apart from the inner presence, there is no such essential difference between one action and another, one kind of instrumentation and another, as would warrant the folly of an egoistic pride. The difference between knowledge and ignorance is a grace of the spirit. The breath of divine power blows where it lists and fills today one and tomorrow another with the word or the puissance. If the potter shapes one pot more perfectly than another, the merit lies not in the vessel, but the maker. The attitude of our mind must not be, "This is my strength," or "Behold God's power in me," but rather, "A divine power works in this mind and body, and it is the same that works in all men and in the animal, in the plant and in the metal, in conscious and living things, and in things apparently inconscient and inanimate." This large view of the one working in all and of the whole world as the equal instrument of a divine action and gradual self-expression, if it becomes our entire experience, will help to eliminate all rajasic egoism out of us, and even the sattvic ego sense will begin to pass away from our nature. The elimination of this form of ego leads straight towards the true instrumental action, which is the essence of a perfect karma yoga. For while we cherish the instrumental ego, we may pretend to ourselves that we are conscious instruments of the divine, but in reality, we are trying to make of the divine Shakti an instrument of our own desires or our egoistic purpose. And even if the ego is subjected but not eliminated, we may indeed be engines of the divine work, but we shall be imperfect tools and deflect or impair the working by our mental errors, our vital distortions, or the obstinate incapacities of our physical nature. If this ego disappears, then we can truly become not only pure instruments consciously consenting to every turn of the divine hand that moves us, but aware of our true nature, conscious portions of the one eternal and infinite put out in herself for her works by the Supreme Shakti. So this is again Bhagavad Gita, in the 13th chapter, the 17th and the 31st shloka, and in the closing 18th chapter, the 61st shloka. So to Sri Aurobindo, this nature is one, even though there seems to the mind to be a dividing threshold above, a bar, a transversal bar that prevents us from knowing what is the truth above and separating from what is the truth below. Really, this para prakriti is always here, and working in prakriti through its unity, if the soul is conjoined with the Supreme in its spiritual status, then nature's work here can singly serve the divine. we become the conscious point, uniting eternity to time, uniting the transcendent to the universe, uniting the knowledge of the Supreme Shakti with what seems to be the formal presentation of an ignorant nature here. And what is ignorant? Ignoring the essence of what we really are. Those boundaries are self-imposed in the involution and can be willfully removed by our awakening selves in our efflorescence back into the fullness of our soul. So again, we come to the Mother, Chapter 5, and that section on work. The last stage of this perfection will come when you are completely identified with the Divine Mother and feel yourself to be no longer another and separate being, instrument, servant, or worker, but truly a child and eternal portion of her consciousness and force. Always she will be in you and you in her. It will be your constant, simple, and natural experience that all your thought and seeing and action, your very breathing or moving, come from her and are hers. You will know and see and feel that you are a person and power formed by her out of herself, put out from her for the play, and yet always safe in her. Being of her being, consciousness of her consciousness, force of her force, Ananda of her Ananda. When this condition is entire, and her supramental energies can freely move you, then you will be perfect in divine works, knowledge, will, action. Will become sure, simple, luminous, spontaneous, flawless, an outflow from the Supreme, a divine movement of the Eternal. So it may seem short, but I think that is where we'll put our bookmark. Looking towards the future and the division of the chapter, I think this is a happy place to close for the evening and turn to Savitri. And this is a passage we haven't read in a while. This is in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. This is in Canto 11, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. We begin on page 271. In a sublimer and more daring soar to the wide summit of the triple stairs, bare steps climbed up like flaming rocks of gold, burning their way to a pure absolute sky. August and few, the sovereign kings of thought, have made of space their wide, all-seeing gaze, surveying the enormous work of time. A breath of all-containing consciousness, supported being in a still embrace. Intercessors with a luminous unseen, they capped in the long passage to the world, the imperatives of the Creator Self, obeyed by unknowing Earth, by conscious Heaven. Their thoughts are partners in its vast control. A great all-ruling consciousness is there, and mind unwitting serves a higher power. It is a channel, not the source of all. The cosmos is no accident in time. There is a meaning in each play of chance. There is a freedom in each face of fate. A wisdom knows and guides the mysteried world. A truth gaze shapes its beings and events. A word self-born upon creation's heights, voice of the eternal in the temporal spheres, prophet of the seeings of the absolute, sows the idea's significance and form, and from that seed the growths of time arise. On peaks beyond our ken, the all wisdom sits. A single and infallible look comes down, a silent touch from the supernal's air awakes to ignorant knowledge in its acts, the secret power in the inconscient depths, compelling the blinded godhead to emerge, determining necessity's nude dance, as she passes through the circuit of the hours and vanishes from the chase of finite eyes down circling vistas of aeonic time. The unseizable forces of the cosmic whirl bear in their bacchant limbs the fixity of an original foresight that is fate. Even nature's ignorance is truth's instrument. Our struggling ego cannot change her course. Yet is it a conscious power that moves in us? A seed idea is parent of our acts, and destiny the unrecognized child of will. Infallibly, by truth's directing gaze, all creatures here their secret self disclose, forced to become what in themselves they hide. For he who is grows manifest in the years, and the slow godhead shut within the cell climbs from the plasm to immortality. But hidden, but denied to mortal grasp, mystic, ineffable is the Spirit's truth, unspoken, caught only by the Spirit's eye. When naked of ego and mind, it hears the voice. It looks through light to ever greater light, and sees eternity in sphering life. This greater truth is foreign to our thoughts. Where a free wisdom works, they seek for a rule, or we only see a tripping game of chance, or a labor in chains forced by bound nature's law, an absolutism of dumb, unthinking power. Audacious in their sense of God-born strength, these dared to grasp with their thought truth's absolute. By an abstract purity of godless sight, by a percept nude, intolerant of forms, they brought to mind what mind could never reach, and hoped to conquer truth's supernal base. A stripped imperative of conceptual phrase, architectonic and inevitable, translated the unthinkable into thought, a silver-winged fire of naked, subtle sense, an ear of mind withdrawn from the outward's rhymes, discovered the seed sounds of the eternal word, the rhythm and music heard that built the worlds and seized in things the bodiless will to be. The illimitable they measured with numbers rods and traced the last formula of limited things in transparent systems, bodied termless truths. The timeless made accountable to time and valued the incommensurable supreme. To park and hedge the ungrasped infinitudes, they erected absolute walls of thought and speech and made a vacuum to hold the one. Namaste, Jai Ma.